Professor Buzzkill here. Before we start the show, I want to tell you about the wonderful work of one of our partners, the Eco Soap Bank. The Eco Soap Bank has one simple mission: employ women to recycle unused hotel soap, purify that soap, and turn it into new soap bars. They then provide that soap to children in need. To date, they've reached over 1.1 million people in 10 developing countries, and they're just getting started. Eco Soap Bank works simultaneously for women, children, and the environment. It's a win-win-win. I'm asking you, please support Project Eco Soap. What they're doing is creating a luxury nonprofit soap product to sell in the United States. The goal is to fund women's employment in developing countries. For every bar sold, Eco Soap will give 100 bars to children in need. Now, that's the best 100-to-1 prospect I've ever heard. Please go to projectecosoap.org and contribute to their Kickstarter campaign. Their bold goal is to reach 2.5 million people with soap and hire 45 more women to achieve that goal by 2020. Eco Soap, the world's first zero-waste, big-impact soap. Today's episode is special. It's an interview I gave to Colin Woodward from the American Rambler podcast. Among other things, we talk about how I started doing this show and about the nature of historical myths and how damaging they can be. Colin even drags a few personal things out of me. Lady Buzzkill will be horrified. On with the show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another edition of American Rambler. I'm your host, Colin Woodward. Thank you for listening to the podcast. On today's show, I have Professor Buzzkill, real name Dr. Joseph Kuhill. Joe has been doing a podcast called Professor Buzzkill for about 5 years now, and we're going to talk about how that podcast got started and how he has also taken on the business of busting myths, as he calls it, and how the historical record and historical memory is often clouded by myths and conspiracy theories and other things that kind of get thrown into the pot when you're talking about history and dealing with history. And some of them are very powerful myths that people don't really want to give up on. And we're kind of seeing that now playing out in politics and pop culture, where in a lot of cases, people are spreading falsehoods or spreading myths and people are believing them. And despite facts, historical or scientific or otherwise, people do not want to give up on these myths. And, you know, it gets very political. You got the people who don't want to believe in climate change and don't want to vaccinate their kids and think Donald Trump is an evangelical Christian or whatever, but there are a lot of myths out there, and you know, it's not always the historian's duty to correct people's misperceptions of things, at least not directly. A lot of them just kind of do the research and do the writing and leave it at that. But I think Joe is kind of part of the larger historical mission, if you want to call it that, of public history, in that you don't just talk about history in the classroom or in papers or in books, but on podcasts and kind of in the public domain. And Joe was certainly on Twitter. He doesn't get involved in debates the way some people do, but he does watch things as they are unfolding on Twitter. We're going to talk a little bit about that. I'm kind of all over the place on Twitter, as I am on this podcast. I don't always talk about history. Sometimes I really don't want to. Same goes with politics. You know, I'll go into sports or literature or movies or whatever, which is one reason why this podcast is called American Rambler, kind of deliberately eclectic. But Joe has stayed very focused, and it has paid off for him. His podcast is doing very well. He's part of an international network now, and our conversation will be coming up in a couple minutes. I hope you're doing okay and your allergies aren't bothering you too much. And I hope you enjoy my conversation with Professor Buzzkill.
How did the podcast come about? How long you've been doing it now?
It's been almost 5 years. It's 2015 I started, and I left academia and was doing some history writing on my own. And then I thought, I'd always liked podcasts, even though they were still kind of new at that stage. And so I thought, well, hell, I'll do one. And because I had always done this thing in class about busting myths and stuff like that, I decided that that would be the sort of, you know, tack that the podcast would take. That would be my specialty rather than just talking about British history or whatever, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think I discovered you on Twitter. And
oh, really?
Because you were putting, you know, a lot of posts up about the podcast. And mm-hmm. at the time, I don't know, yeah, it was maybe around 2015, I guess. You'd probably been doing it for a year or so. I don't know, were there really any other history podcasts going on at the time?
I think there were a couple that were piggybacking off of other things like PBS shows. History shows like Backstory, I think, has been around for a long time. And yeah. They would just put out a podcast version of their TV show. Now, I think they do their own podcast in addition to the TV show. So okay. Things like that. And the BBC would spin off its shows that were history-based into a BBC. There isn't a BBC history podcast, as far as I know, but there's so many on the BBC feed that it might as well be a history podcast.
Yeah. Well, because your background is English history. So
that's right. That's
you
right.
probably listen to a lot of the BBC.
Yeah. And I'm starting to listen to the BBC more and more now because American politics is getting tiresome. It's also getting tiresome just to even listen to it as much as important as it is.
Yeah.
Some channels that I like used to like listening to talk about nothing but Trump. And so after a while, I just, well, okay.
No, I'm the same way. I've had to tune out a lot of it. I mean, I used to watch Bill Maher's show and I just couldn't handle it after a while. It's just the anger is just unrelenting. And
yeah, and I might agree with him personally, but it's just, right. You know, there are other subjects in the world and there are other things happening in the world. And so that's why I'd always been listening to the BBC sort of, but I really just sort of switched over.
Yeah. Have you done an episode on Brexit?
No, because I don't understand it. it's just so complicated. And it's not, I tend to try to stay away from any 21st century stuff because it's just too fresh and too new and it needs time to settle and you need time for people to study it professionally.
Yeah.
So I could do a show, so there's a very good idea. I should think about this. I could do a show on Britain and the European Union, you know, on general things about attitudes towards the European Union going into Europe in the 70s and the ways the various sort of gradual ways they went into Europe in the 70s. And that would be, you know, that's more history than current event.
Well, maybe you could wrap it up into like a show about not, I guess they don't call it secession over there, but sort of like independence movements in Britain between, you know, the Northern Ireland movement and Scotland. They just voted on that like a couple of years ago, or maybe it was longer than that. It was like seven years ago.
It's true that the Union, you know, the Union part of the United Kingdom is very interesting and fraught with all sorts of complications. So. Yeah, I could do that. That's a very good idea. I think I'll write that down.
Okay. Well, you have Professor Nash in a lot. He's kind of like your cleanup hitter. does he know a lot about English politics?
No. Well, okay. I mean, he knows enough to teach. Sorry, this sounds snarky, but I don't mean it to be. He knows enough to teach Western Civ and to teach world history and things like that.
Yeah.
And in fact, we just did a Man Crush Monday show coming out that will come out soon on a soldier in the British Army, an Indian soldier in the British Army. And so he had known, you know, a lot about that, enough about that to do a show. But if I didn't have an Americanist to help me, and someone who's as good as he is, then I don't think the show would get anywhere.
You know? Yeah, he's really good. You know, yeah, I can kind of talk about anything. And I'm sure, you know, between the two of you, you could, you know, get us through British politics of the last 200 years or so. But was your research more focused on the 19th century, like the early, mid 19th century?
Yes.
Okay.
I worked on the early development of the Liberal Party.
Yeah.
Which there are debates about whether it started in the 1850s and 1860s. And I originally wanted to do that, the 1850s and the 1860s, but a professor that I knew convinced me that that had already been done. Why don't you see if there's any sort of evidence or realistic evidence for a nascent Liberal Party in the 30s and 40s, 1830s and 40s. And so that's what I did.
Okay. Now, I don't know anything about them. Are they liberal in kind of the modern sense or the classical sense?
Well, more in the classical sense, in the sense that free trade,
okay,
but also religious liberty. So the liberals are the ones who really try to break down all the what we would call, you know, the British liberals are the ones who try to put up all the separations between church and state.
Okay,
and even now technically there isn't one, but they still try to put up a number of barriers between church and state, and in fact especially did that with regard to Ireland. So the Church of Ireland, for instance, the Anglican Church in Ireland, which is called the Church of Ireland, was an establishment church, and you had to pay taxes to it. No, it didn't matter whether you were Anglican or Catholic or whatever in Ireland. And in 1869, the Liberal government under William Gladstone disestablished the Church of Ireland without disestablishing the Church of England. So he said, basically the argument was, look, this is a special case. We can't be taxing these people who are overwhelmingly Catholic to pay for an Anglican church.
Okay.
And that goes through and that sort of thing works.
Yeah.
And there are a number of other examples like that too.
Okay. Okay. Well, that's interesting. British politics. No, I mean, right now, if you're trying to figure out what the hell is going on, it's incomprehensible. And I don't even think people there understand what's going on.
Oh, no, they don't, because it's too many. There are too many options. There are too many, you know, Theresa May's government's come up with, well, first of all, almost nobody except the sort of radical right wing of the Tory party wanted the Brexit referendum to pass. And so suddenly the conservatives are faced with this thing that some of their party want and most of their party don't want, but the country wants, at least a majority of those who voted wanted. And so they've got to come up with some way to do this that makes it as painless as possible.
Cause, yeah.
You know, I mean, it's incredible how many, I mean, in one way, the connection with the European Union is easy, but in other ways, it's also difficult because for Britain, they have put in all sorts of exemptions and exceptions way back in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And, you know, it really was the sort of exception within the European Union. And so, you know, still driving on the left, for instance. Now, that's a silly example, but that also explains how Britain is still can remain different from Europe. And so now having to pull out of all that and yet still try to keep the British economy afloat, you know, because once that happens, their trade with Europe becomes immensely more complicated and problematic and probably not as good. You know, they try to figure all that out and still please the or still placate the people who voted for Brexit. It'd be unbelievably difficult.
Yeah.
And so that's why they have all these different plans, and none of them are perfect. And one group doesn't want one, and one group doesn't want the other. So it just keeps. It's endless. It's almost endless.
Yeah, it's just a real mess, and it's I guess it's not coincidental, but I mean, that it dovetailed so perfectly with the Trump election. I mean, you just kind of get this right wing insanity. I think for a while it was kind of like a bluff on, you know, Trump's end, and didn't think he was going to win, and then he wins, and now we're trying to sort all this out, but it kind of sounds like there was some of that in Great Britain, like the conservatives were sort of bluffing with it to put it up to a vote.
Yeah, and in fact, the main bluffer was Boris Johnson, who's been in various conservative cabinets over the years, but he's a real serious blowhard, and he just wants public attention and public support. And so he's, while he may be anti-Europe, you know, in his own political mind, he just whips it up on his own just in order to be, I don't know, gain more attention.
Yeah. And
so when this thing passed, when the referendum passed, you know, you saw the film of him after on the next day looking rather sheepish, like, well, I didn't expect anyone to actually do it, you know. And so that's the problem. And that's why the way Trump looked after the election the next day, you know, he looked like, I only wanted to run. I only wanted to run to gain more attention. And now I've won. What do I do?
Well, I don't know. Was it going to be another year or so before they get it figured out?
They've extended it to the end of October, and that's perfectly apropos because it's Halloween when they'll end up doing it.
All right.
Or if that doesn't work, they'll figure out some other extension. I don't know how the French and the Germans put up with them, frankly. The French and the Germans have done an amazing work since the war, not only preventing themselves from fighting each other, which, as you know, was every other generation, there's a big Franco-German war. They've really developed this frankly wonderful thing called the European Union, and Britain has always been a problem, and not willing to play the game, or only willing to play it up to a certain point, and always wanting exceptions and special cases and circumstances. It just must drive them crazy.
Yeah.
So in some ways, I sometimes think the French especially, were like, well, whenever this takes place, whenever you do exit, we'll be very glad to see you go because you've been a pain in the ass.
Well, I guess it's, you know, it's a long history of England being an island nation and sort of developing their own way and fighting wars their own way and, you know, creating an empire in its own way. So now it's sort of, that's all coming to the forefront. I kind of feel the same way in the U.S. I mean, every time one of the southern states doesn't feel like it's getting its own way, it kind of brings up secession again, and it's probably all BS, but sometimes I'm just like, you know, if you want to do it, go for it. Texas, you want to be your own thing, just leave, you know, at least have the balls to do it for once. But they don't really mean it.
Who was that? I think it was in Lincoln's cabinet, or said, you know, wayward sisters depart in peace. The guy, whoever said, you know, when the Civil War was just starting, he said that, you know, like, go.
Oh, I'm not sure about that.
I want to say it's William Seward, but see, well, I don't like to speculate because speculation leads to myth building.
Yes. Well, I'll have to look up, but I think that's a good segue into the myth business in history. And I mean, your show is sort of built around that. When you initially started, that was your idea to kind of talk about myths throughout history?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Because I knew that, and you know this, unless you're truly famous, and by that I mean Oprah famous, you can't just talk about general things on the podcast. You'll get no audience. You have to be specific, and you have to be specific enough in something that you're a relative expert in. And this had always been on my mind, in busting myths, even when I was teaching. So that's what I thought. Well, that'll be my hook. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And did it take off pretty quickly initially?
Yes and no. It did. Here's another thing that happened, and this actually was very heartening. I felt very good about the public / American public after this happened. When I started this, I thought, well, no one, and I mean no one, is going to want to hear me talk about the depths of a Churchill myth or the depths of a World War II myth or the depths of a myth about Ireland for an hour, I'm going to have to get, you know, local comedians on and have a sort of panel discussion and make it lighthearted and give them a little bit of history that they can take away with and then maybe build on.
Yeah.
Well, that was disastrous. People eventually, my friends kind of had to sit me down like a sort of an alcoholic's intervention and say, look, we don't want this jokey panel discussion. It's worthless. We want the real thing. And so I said, all right. So I switched it to what we do now, which is pretty much 40 minutes or an hour, depending on the real stuff. And we don't try to dumb it down. And our numbers went through the roof. So there are lots of people out there, not only who could obviously handle the sophisticated stuff, but who want it. And I was obviously being very arrogant by thinking initially that, oh, you know, I can't let my Aunt Ginger hear this stuff about Churchill. You know, we'll have to have a few jokes and we'll have to do this and have to be like a panel game. Well, it turns out, you know, she was one of the ones who said, what are you doing? I don't want to hear this junk. I want to hear the real thing.
Yeah. No,
so that's why we changed format, and it really did make a huge difference. So that made me feel good about people. You know, they didn't want, you know, junk.
Yeah. I think that's true. I think the more popular podcasts, I mean, I guess there are some that are sort of general or more entertainment driven, broadly speaking, but no, I mean, with the history podcasts that I know, they're pretty focused.
Sorry.
Well, like, you know, Liz Kovart's podcast, Ben Franklin's World, hers is very structured. And I guess just myself by nature, I just can't do that. So I've kind of been all over the place, but, you had set it all up yourself initially, like you were uploading and editing and doing all that.
Oh no.
Okay.
Oh God, no.
Okay.
All I was doing was sort of setting up the script, if you will, the outline, the rundown, whatever, and then recording the show. And I was using professional sound editors to not only edit the thing, but to upload it to Libsyn, which I don't know if your listeners know is the main syndicator for podcasts.
Yeah.
And I was in the network, you know, one of the benefits about doing a Kickstarter before, which is like a GoFundMe thing, was that I had enough money that I could get the good equipment and start paying people to help to do the real work. I mean, to do the real specialized technical work.
Okay, and eventually you became part of a network.
That's right. The guys I hired who could do the audio stuff said, hey, we like this show. Can we put it in our network, which is called Epicast. And that worked out very well. And then I got an offer from a network in Toronto, which was a much bigger deal. And so I went with them 2.5 years ago or something.
Okay.
And so, yeah, it's called Entertainment One and it's run out of Toronto and it's worldwide. It's much more of a multimedia, so to speak. I mean, they produce movies, they do all kinds of TV, all kinds of things.
So you went from paying.
So I was really happy about that.
So you went from paying someone to getting paid for the podcast.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's great. That's great.
Now it's not a ton of money, you know, I'm not rolling in it, but
yeah,
it makes a big difference when I can have all the professional stuff done and don't have to shell out anymore.
Yeah, that's nice. Because I think for me, the content is what it is, whatever I do, but it's the technical stuff that's really driven me crazy.
Well, and lots of people say that, like Ed, who runs the In the Past Lane.
Oh, yeah,
He does it all himself, and I don't see how you guys do it. I mean, the editing takes 4 or 5 times longer than the actual recording.
Yeah, sometimes it does. And I've had ones that – usually the ones online are more of a nightmare because you can have cutouts and – words that garble and stuff like that. But you have the knowledge base. So you feel like you can navigate pretty easily through various periods. I mean, I know you bring in guests and stuff. But I'm guessing as a historian and someone who's taught and everything, you can kind of hold your own with anybody.
I had taught long enough, and I had taught enough American history, for instance, that I could have the sense of when I had done enough research for an episode that it was going to work. I still don't, you know, I'm not willing to go out on my own and do a show on, we're doing a show soon on the myth that surrounds the War of the Worlds.
Oh,
radio
podcast. Orson Welles.
Yeah. And that I know a lot about, but I didn't really know enough. And so I got other experts. In this case, they didn't want to be on the show, but they gave me all the important journal articles and all the important books to read. And I find that interesting, that subject interesting anyway. So that was that's a kind of example of one where I can get out of my field and do something. But it's been, you know, it takes a year. Something that's really out of my bailiwick takes about a year to do all the background reading and all the stuff that's necessary. So do need those guests that we talk about, you know, to come in and fill out, because otherwise, you know, I'd come out with a show every 6 months or something.
Yeah. How many shows have you done altogether now? Do you know?
I think we're up to number 305. That numbering system didn't start. I just looked on the
server. Okay.
Didn't start until, or it got messed up somehow early on, because we were having different types of shows and we were starting them at number one as well. So we'd have a full episode number one, then we'd have these Woman Crush Wednesdays or number one.
Okay.
Probably have close to 400 total since we've started, but the number is 305.
Okay, so that's about one per week then, give or take.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. No, I love your show. It's definitely my favorite history podcast. But I'm not sure when you heard of podcasts and stuff. Probably 2009, 2010, maybe.
I think I actually bought an iPod. You know, they don't exist anymore, but I think I did, and I think that's how I got started.
Okay. And I'm guessing your experience in graduate school was pretty traditional in terms of how to write history, how to research.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did they ever talk about?
What I did was, I remember in grad school they were starting something called the Oxford Student Radio, called Oxford Student Radio, and a call went out to anybody want to host a show, and I said, I want to host a show, and we called it the Oxford History Podcast, the Oxford History Podcast. And I went, I took my friends and I, who were also doing research, and I interviewed them about their research. And it was absolutely terrible. It was boring. You know, we went, and I think it lasted about 7 or 8 episodes, and then it collapsed of its own. And I don't know what happened to Oxford Student Radio after that. But that made me think, and I didn't really realize this until much, much later, that I kind of like promoting other people's history rather than doing my own. So I like talking about your book and saying, okay, well, this is going to help explain, you know, slavery and race conceptions within the Confederate Army. And we can talk about the slave soldier myth and things like that. And I can say, oh, you know, I've got Colin Woodward on and blah, 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 blah. It can be a kind of like a Graham Norton of podcasting. And I really liked that. And I didn't realize it, but I also liked it way back when, which is 93, 94, when I started that other thing. And so it also has taught me something about myself, which is, you know, I generally don't like to say things like that because it just sounds so trite, so overused, but that's true.
Yeah, this is Oxford, England. Okay,
yeah.
So you were studying at Oxford?
Yeah, I did my PhD there.
Yeah, well, that's a good school. And so you were, I mean, you went full in with the English experience. I mean, you wanted to study in England.
Yeah.
You wanted to write about England.
Yeah.
Is that just something you kind of grew up with, English history?
No, actually, it happened kind of by accident. I originally, when I was an undergrad, wanted to do Chinese history.
Oh, wow.
And I can't remember why I wanted to do Chinese history, but I think I did. But then we had to take a certain number of upper division European courses, and I took a British history course, and I just completely fell in love with the professor's way of teaching it, the subject matter, and everything. And so that was it. Once I started down that road, I got the opportunity to do my master's degree in Australia. And once I had done that, I was sort of in the British system, if you know what I mean. The British system of graduate work is very different from the American. And it made more sense for me to go from Melbourne, Australia, where I was, to Oxford, rather than to come back here and to try the American PhD program.
Yeah, well, I did a few months in London at King's College, and that was just at the undergraduate level, but it seemed a lot more independent to me. Was that true at the graduate level too?
Oh yeah, probably even more so, because you're given it. They just assume that you are, because of the way the undergraduate program works, they assume you already know your different fields, you know, to a certain degree. So they don't have comps, for instance, for graduate students. I had to pass a certain thing which dealt with British history and whether my dissertation would work in British history, so to speak. But I didn't have to go off and study up on modern Germany and all things like that. So you become very, 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 very specialized, and your specialized knowledge is very deep. But like I said, perfect example is Professor Nash. He's an Americanist, but he can talk about modern Germany.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm a British historian. I can't talk about anything but British history and Irish history.
Yeah. Well, that was probably, that was my experience at the graduate level. We had to do minor fields. So I did German history. I did Southern literature. Exactly. Even as specialized as I felt it was at times, you are still getting kind of a broad swath of American history.
And a lot of that, I think, has to do with the way history departments work and history departments teach their undergrads. So when you get a PhD at an American university, you can go off and teach Western Civ, and you can go off and teach world history. Whereas, in fact, those courses don't exist at Oxford or Cambridge. You know, everything is specialized.
Yeah, that's true. Now that I think of it, because my classes at King's were very specific. They, had a specialty in military history, which was really cool. But for someone like me, you're really getting thrown in the deep end with all these European wars of, the 18th, 19th century. But I liked that independence because they had a lot less class time than we do in the States. I mean, they had like a month off before finals. So I just had like a month to walk around London and kind of soak that all up, which is great.
Yeah. They do expect a more, at the undergraduate level finals and at the graduate level, the dissertation is expected to be really very, very serious and very specialized. Yeah. But it is very different. By the way, I should apologize to your listeners. It's spring break here in the Buzzkill, in the Duchy of Buzzkill, and a lot of the buzzlings are running around my house today. Okay. So if there's any noise in the background, it's one of them yelling about some video game.
And both of your kids, were they born in England?
Those two kids that I talk about on the show and that do promos for the show, that's fictional. We just thought it was funny to have a lady buzzkill and to have an, and then we have children, and I gave them very posh Antonia and Sebastian,
That, all right. Cause the numbers that didn't seem to add up chronologically with your
No. I only have one child, a 15-year-old son. And by the way, my father is not the Duke of Buzzkill. My mother is not the Duchess of Buzzkill.
That's alive?
Yes, they're alive, but they don't like being called the Duke and Duchess of Buzzkill. It's funny that a show about myths is built on at least three.
Yeah, so you're
myths.
You're creating your own myths. You're kind of your self-made myth.
Yeah. Well, I kind of thought that everyone was getting the joke, but maybe I've been wrong. Maybe
no,
wrong
I was totally. I don't know about your. No, I mean, I think I believed it all. That's how gullible I am.
All right.
I said, no, this makes sense. Joe, he studied in England. So, but Did you have plans to stay in England, or were you always thinking of coming back?
That's a very good question. The way I remember it, I applied for jobs in both places, and I got a job in England, and then I can't remember why, but I really started to hit the American job market pretty hard, and the offers were so interesting that I took one of them at Gettysburg College, which is a 1-year replacement job, and loved it, and then I've stayed ever since. So stayed back home. But people look at my resume and they sort of like, wait a minute, you got your bachelor's degree here, and then you got your master's, and are you even American?
If they've listened to the show, I would think they would know you're American. You're from Pennsylvania?
Originally, I was actually born in Ohio.
If you're in Pittsburgh, you're pretty much in Ohio.
Yeah, almost.
So the job market, I'm guessing, was a lot better back then. When was this?
This is around the year 2000. No, it wasn't really that better. Although what I read on Twitter makes it sound a lot worse than when I was applying for jobs. So maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think it was any better back then, but maybe it was.
I was on the market 2005, 2004, 2005, and that was pretty great, I think, compared to what's going on now. But I was also a newly minted PhD. I think it's easier. But I think generally speaking, it's gotten pretty bad, and really kind of filtered down into everything. It feels like I feel like everything is searching for a tenure track job now.
Yeah, that's the way it certainly is, what I hear from my friends, but also from reading. And it's amazing how so many historians are on Twitter.
Yeah.
None are on Instagram, for instance, but the historical discussions on Twitter, the real ones from real historians, are very good.
Yeah.
I learned an awful lot.
Yeah, for sure.
And so, that's how I kind of met you, right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
And so when I read about the job, that people's job struggles on Twitter, I think, ooh, I'm glad I'm out.
You know? Well, and honesty too. I mean, some of the people that I follow on Twitter that are very vocal about the job market, they don't have to really have a tenure track job. They are, they're self-employed, or they've got family money, or I don't know what, but like it's not a choice between a tenure track job and unemployment. It's kind of like, I'd love to teach, but I've got these other things going on, or my spouse makes, X amount of dollars, and I'll have to teach. So they have a lot more freedom than a lot of people. But then there are people who are teaching 12 classes a year, and it's just insane. They're doing work. So it's a swath of people, but no, I get a lot out of it. Some days I feel like the world is coming to an end if you read Twitter too much,
especially around grading time.
Yeah. Have you ever thought about doing a book about podcasting?
No, although I would if someone wanted me to do it, and I got sort of more general help. What I'm working on now, believe it or not, is a book called The Churchill Cult.
Okay.
It's about how myths about Churchill started and how they built, and especially how they built in the United States.
Yeah, well, maybe we can talk about him a little bit, because I know you've done at least a couple shows about him specifically, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What is maybe the number one myth about Churchill that you can think of?
Well, I sort of break down myths about Churchill between two categories. One is stuff he didn't say.
Yeah. Right?
That he gets credit for saying everything, quotes. But the other is a sort of big myths. And the biggest myth is that, and I see this written even by academics, that Churchill, quote, saved Western civilization. And that has always bothered me for two reasons. One, because he didn't. Two, because it's part of this great man, and now I hope we say great person, theory of history, that, Churchill himself did this one thing. Whereas in reality, there were hundreds of government workers and military personnel and thousands of soldiers in the British Army and the American Army. It's just crazy to say that Churchill saved us from Hitler, especially when you look into it and you see that an awful lot of what Churchill gets credit for was done by Neville Chamberlain before Churchill came to power. And what had happened, and this is one of the things you talk about in your book and lots of people talk about, is a popular book written after the war called Guilty Men, which was basically a screed saying that Neville Chamberlain and all the quote appeasers unquote, you know, brought the war on. And that Churchill was the great savior because he wasn't an appeaser and all this stuff. Well, that's just literally not true. Even though Chamberlain tried to do everything he could to not get involved in the war or not, you know, be in the war, but he's the one who declared war against Hitler. And he's the one who made all of the initial overtures to the United States to try to get the United States involved in the war. Churchill gets this great credit for, you know, he's the one who convinced Roosevelt to be in the war and all that kind of stuff. And it's just, I mean, I'm getting all my blood pressure's rising because it's literally not true.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it is true that Churchill and Roosevelt were in contact almost every day, but Roosevelt was saying to him, no, there's nobody in the United States wants to get in this war. There's nobody in the United States wants to pay for this war. There's nobody in the United States wants to lend you the money for this war. We're not doing it. And he's saying in more diplomatic language, of course, but Churchill believes that he can convince FDR of this. And what's worse, in my opinion, because it's the historical and the historiographical crime, is that people have believed that it was because of Churchill that he was able to drag the U.S. in the war, when that's just literally not true. It's the Japanese at Pearl Harbor who dragged the United States into the war.
Yeah. Yeah. I did an episode on Charles Bukowski, of all people, and kind of his take on World War II, and that it is really Pearl Harbor that changes people's perception.
Absolutely.
Because isolationism was very strong.
FDR would not have been able to get a war declaration through Congress before Pearl Harbor. Just wouldn't have had, it would have been voted down. And then afterwards, after Pearl Harbor, it's passed by whatever it is, 450-1 or whatever the House of Representatives was at that time.
Yeah. There's so many myths you can kind of get into with World War II. I think you've done an episode on Pearl Harbor, maybe with, I think it was with Professor Nash. And
yes, that's right.
And talking about that myth of FDR sort of baiting the Japanese or wanting Pearl Harbor to get decimated so that he could get into the war.
Yeah, well, there's just certainly no evidence of that. And it's also, it would have been a crazy thing to do. In the first place, if Roosevelt really wanted something to get the Congress and the American people motivated about a war, he would have let the Japanese attack the Philippines, which everyone thought was going to happen anyway. They thought that was going to be the place where the U.S. was going to get attacked by Japan. He wouldn't have said, hey, there's this little chain of islands called Hawaii, and we have a lot of ships, so why don't you attack them? He would have said, do it in the Philippines, because not only is it did everyone think that was going to happen anyway, and there were American naval bases there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There weren't anywhere near as many ships and important ships there as there were in Pearl Harbor. So if he was, if somehow he was trying to figure out some way to get the U.S. in the Pacific War first and then, the follow-on from that, the European War, he would have somehow, figured it out so that they attacked the Philippines, because it wouldn't have destroyed as much American stuff.
Right, right, yeah. No, I mean, there's just that whole idea that a president would want
absolutely.
A military
absolutely.
Base of that importance to get wiped out almost.
Right, yeah.
It's just insane. Crazy. But I'm sure you've probably talked about this, but sort of there's a fine line sometimes between a historical myth and a conspiracy theory.
Yes. Yeah. I tend to think conspiracy theories are worse.
Yes, it's more sinister.
It's more sinister, and they're a lot weirder usually.
Yeah.
And they soak up a lot more attention. I can't tell you how bad the JFK movie was, though it had Kevin Costner in it, however many, 20 years ago now. And what you know, people just literally believe it like it's a documentary.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's it's a terrible thing to think, and it's a terrible thing to let yourself be convinced of by a movie.
But right.
Of course, conspiracy theories have all these books and all this other stuff. And if people understand the nature of evidence and the nature of argumentation, they would see that they're full of holes. But, you know, it's a movie, people buy it. The popular books, people buy it. So yeah. That's what worries me about conspiracy theories. And of course, conspiracy theories lead to that, I think, situations like that guy who shot up that pizza parlor last year, or maybe it was 2016, crazy believing that Hillary Clinton had set something up in the basement of this pizza parlor in D.C. where they were, you know, planning some overthrow of the U.S. government. So he shows up and then goes to this pizza parlor and starts shooting people. I mean, this is not only historically crazy, but it's, you know, it's evil and vicious in terms of what people will then do. I don't think people are going to do that sort of thing based on a mistaken Churchill quote or a mistaken FDR quote or mistaken idea about Lincoln. But
yeah.
Something like that happens. But also, you know, the whole, as you know better than I do, the whole lost cause mythology after the Civil War is basically one huge conspiracy theory. And it had terrible, absolutely terrible effects on U.S. politics well into my lifetime.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's. You know, I've spent a lot of time thinking about that and to a certain degree writing about that because, yeah, it does sort of, you do cross that line sometimes between the myths and then the conspiracy theory. And I guess, you know, it's partly people wanting to make sense of a tragedy in some sort of logical way, even if the logic is pretty faulty. But that was one thing my advisor tried to do in his Civil War class, Charles Royster. I think he had a whole 80-minute lecture about Civil War myths, and I tried to do that, you know, combating that myth that, you know, Confederates were outnumbered at every battle 3-1, and you know, they never had a chance. But
they were still more heroic.
They were better soldiers, but the North just overwhelmed them through, you know, sheer attrition. And, you know, some ways that's a bit true, but if you study it deeply as I have, I mean, you realize that a lot of battles, the Confederates had more men. They weren't fighting thinking they were going to lose, obviously. So that lost cause, you know, merges after to make sense of this enormous tragedy. But no, we're still seeing that play out now. And
I think certainly in American history and maybe in world history, that's the most destructive historical myth of any that I know.
Really?
You know, I mean, there isn't any. Well, the parallel myth that might be happening in Germany, or the parallel interpretation happening in Germany, post-war neo-Nazi. That's extremely minor compared to the just horrible things that happened in the U.S. between the 1930s and the 1960s because of the lost cause mythology.
So, like, after World War One, I mean, in Germany, there's that stab in the back myth that emerges.
That's another example, yeah.
But do you find that less pervasive? At least, because it stops after World War Two, right? I mean...
Certainly,
once the Nazis
absolutely.
Are defeated. Yeah, okay.
And I find that, and this is possibly going to get me in trouble with neo-Confederates out there, but what there wasn't in the United States after the Civil War, you know, during the Reconstruction period, there wasn't a denazification of the Confederacy. And, of course, when Johnson comes in, he's even more lenient than Lincoln was. So... there isn't this idea, you know, the whole redemption thing about being able to come back and run for political office and everything. That's a real problem. I mean, there were thousands and thousands of Nazi officers who were weren't high ranking enough to execute, or weren't high ranking enough to be sent to jail for Holocaust crimes, but we're basically, you know, you're out. You don't get to run for political office. You don't get to hold jobs in politics. You don't get to hold jobs in the civil service now for the rest of your life. And that really, as everyone knows, you teach world history, you know, very, very serious holding down, if you will, or very, very serious attempts to stop that sort of, exactly the same thing about the stab in the back myth. The Germans knew that, okay, we can't let this stab in the back, a certain type of a stab in the back myth arise again after the Nazis, because, you know, neo-Nazis are going to be just as horrific as the first group of Nazis.
Yeah.
And so although I don't say it much in public because I'm literally afraid, I really do believe that there should have been a denazification of the Confederacy after the war. And it would have been harsh, but it would have been better in the long run.
Well, that's interesting. And I don't know if anyone's ever taught a class on that. Maybe it's just, it's too explosive politically to be comparing those two things. But that's an interesting point because I've written a lot about all those guys who just come back into power in the South after the war, nothing ever happened. I mean, Jefferson Davis is in prison for 2 years and that's about it. No one's even, like you said, prevented from being in a position of power. I mean, there were a few.
They come back pretty quickly. And it's really shameful that the United States let that happen.
Well, it's weird because there are a lot of reasons why that happens. I think just given the nature of the war, it's to some degree kind of a heroic war. And so these people like Robert E. Lee are held up as heroes, even in the North to a certain degree. And there's also a lot of fear in the North about African Americans gaining power. Mm-hmm. And maybe if, you know, we can't trust them to hold power in the South, or we're worried they might leave and move up North. So there's that kind of, they want to keep the brakes on racially, even in the North. There is a lot that comes out of Reconstruction, but it's still fairly limited. I mean, you know, black men get the right to vote and they get citizenship, but the South can figure out ways around that, as they obviously did. It's a total mess. It is pretty shocking when you first are studying Reconstruction in late 19th century and you just, you know, one guy after another, if they're not in power politically, they're running a railroad or they've got a job teaching somewhere. There are guys that sort of sink after the war, but then there are other guys they just go about leading their lives and no one ever bothers them again. It's pretty astounding.
Obviously the lower ranking people and the infantry and the enlisted men and all that sort of thing, there has to be a way to let them come back into society normally. But the officers, you know, you could tell them, look, you know, you could be a farmer, you can be a businessman, you could be a merchant in your town and everything, but we're not going to let you hold a job with any national banks or national railroads, as you say, because you were involved in treason.
It's very interesting to see that all unfold. And I think there was a certain amount of just, we need to get back to the way things were. So we're going to give the planters their land back and keep African-Americans working the land. And hopefully everything will be forgiven and forgotten. And, by the 1880s, that's kind of when you see it. That backlash sort of ends and, whatever it is, the New South, they want to settle the frontier. So it's just keep the economic engine running. And let's just forget about the war. But
historians have a lot of blame for that too, because certainly starting in the 1880s, the whole lost cause mythology comes up and the whole Lew Wallace thing and all those things about Gone with the Wind, for instance, eventually within 50 years, most of the culture believes all that stuff.
Yeah.
Most of the culture everywhere in the country believes all that stuff. And it's really, it's very troubling that that happened.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I talked to Gaines Foster recently, and he's written about the Confederacy and Lost Cause. And he did make me think about some things and how a lot of what we're seeing now with the Confederate flag is about, you know, massive resistance akin to the civil rights movement. But that certainly all has its source in, you know, the post-war period and glorifying the flag. And I mean, if you came down here to Richmond, we could just walk around my neighborhood and see multiple Confederate flags. I mean, it's pretty crazy. And driving through the counties, I mean, there's just a lot of that iconography still around. Some of it is sort of morphed into Tea Party flags and Trump flags, but it all kind of has that common source, I think, around here anyway.
It's worrying, very worrying.
I don't know what's going to happen in 2020, but if we do get a change, that'll settle things down a bit. But it's funny to see things just from a couple of years ago. You'll watch a TV program, like I was watching Anthony Bourdain's show, and he had an episode in Houston, and he was talking a lot about immigrants and how they've assimilated. And this was early 2016 or something. And I kind of wonder if someone went back and kind of talked to those people again, if things have changed, because there's just so much more intolerance than there was even a couple of years ago right now.
Yeah, things might have regressed. It might be very visible that they regressed.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, especially a place like Texas, I hate to say it. I've seen a lot of that here in Virginia, being a former Confederate state. But I wanted to get back to movies for a minute, and we've been going about an hour, so I don't want to keep you on forever. But did you see The Favorite?
No, I haven't seen
it
yet.
I'd be interested to see what you thought of it. I mean, it's early 1700s.
Yeah, technically not my period, right? But yeah. I have heard a lot of British historians talk about it, and they like a lot of things about it. They like a lot of this social history they like a lot of the ways the social history is being projected, for instance. And that is not as bad as a lot of other movies have been about early modern period, and not as bad as it could have been, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, and there are some technical things involved with the movie I thought were interesting. Like I heard that they shot it only using natural lighting. So the daytime scenes are kind of gloomy and the nighttime scenes are just, you know, candlelit. But I thought that made it very atmospheric, and it had a very that's a dangerous word to use, but authentic look to it.
Yeah.
And
no, that's very interesting. I didn't know that at all.
I think the history is pretty flawed, but at least looking at it, the costumes and the settings looked very real to me. But I've kind of given up with movies in terms of,
it's tough.
It'll just drive you
crazy.
Well,
I think that certainly in the modern world, this is the most damaging to historical accuracy, because of the movies are the most damaging to historical accuracy, because, you know, like the Pearl Harbor movie, or I think the most recent Pearl Harbor movie has, or implies that there's this conspiracy, this sort of pro-Japanese conspiracy, and that's why all the planes were lined up wing to wing on the airstrips in Pearl Harbor, or on the aircraft carriers in Pearl Harbor, and therefore more easy to bomb. And there's just literally no evidence for this. There's evidence that they were doing that for other organizational reasons, and of course everyone thought if anything happens, it's going to happen in the Philippines. But it makes it look as if this whole group of people were sort of, you know, half traitors. And for Patton, I don't know if many of your readers remember, many of your listeners remember this, but the Patton movie starring George C. Scott in the 70s is full of myths. And of course, everyone believes that that's what happened, including all the quotes in the movie, all the things that were written by screenwriters that literally didn't happen.
Yeah.
And, you know, what are you going to, I mean, we did a show on Patton just, you know, about this. Patton was a very important general. Patton was a sort of second or third rate general in terms of quality. Then the army assesses these things after the war. But in the movie, you know, he comes across as winning the war, which is just shocking.
Well, we read his memoir for a military history class, and I think that's pretty much the way he thought of himself. He didn't, obviously, right? But no, that movie, I think it was written by Francis Ford Coppola. So he, you know, he's not a historian.
Yeah. But what bothers me about that is he's not an idiot.
Right.
He should know better. You know?
Yeah.
But I think a lot of film directors think that, you know, people are going to understand that this is, quote, just a movie. They're not going to go off thinking that all this stuff actually happened. But
yeah, no, I think on the one hand, I've sort of come to an understanding that I know Hollywood is going to change things. They want to tell a good story and they're not going to worry about facts getting in the way of a good story. But at the same time, I do feel like you have an obligation to be true to the historic record. I mean, I think you can do both. You can make an entertaining movie that is factual, and something like The Patriot, which, did you see that? The Mel Gibson?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's a dumb Rambo entertainment kind of movie, but they could have included things that were historically accurate, that, you know, the atrocities that the British were doing. But instead they have a house, they have a church burning down with people inside it. I mean, the British didn't do that, but that's something out of Nazi Germany. So they figure, oh, this will make the guy more villainous. But
and people now believe that that actually
happened. Right. Yeah. So I'm skeptical, but you're right. I mean, these things get embedded in people's brains and they just assume they're true. And I've done it too. Yeah. I've just assumed things in a movie were accurate, and it's taken me years, my whole life.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Any biopic is just loaded up with myth making of whoever, the screenwriter.
That's certainly true.
Something like Amadeus took me a long time to sort of parse out.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And the the Jesse James movies are always complete fiction. I mean, complete as in almost starting from the very beginning, making all the whole thing up as they go along.
Yeah. No, you did a recent episode about Jesse James, which was really good, because you cut through all of that to kind of show him for the psychopath that he really was.
Well, and again, I shouldn't get any credit for doing that. That was all Professor Nash and Professor Stiles who wrote the book.
Yeah.
Jesse James and the Civil War, the last. I mean, that's really just an absolutely fantastic book. But just the simple idea that Jesse James was way out west.
Right.
You know, fighting in Arizona, when it's just literally not true. He never goes west of Missouri. And I don't want to say something is trite and mind blowing, but it is mind blowing that these things are just completely made up.
Yeah. Yeah. I recently watched the movie about Bonnie and Clyde, although it really wasn't about Bonnie and Clyde. It was about the lawman that took him down.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I've seen that.
Okay. Well, you should watch it. And maybe if you did something about Bonnie and Clyde or Depression era gangsters, because I wrote a book.
Yeah. Okay.
I read a book called Go Down Together about Bonnie and Clyde that really opened my eyes to that whole story.
Okay.
And in, you know, contrast to the 67 movie with Faye Dunaway, and you know, it's a great movie, but
Warren Beatty.
Right. I mean, it's so, you know, faulty with a lot of the history, but you know, I guess that's what historians are for. I just don't know if you can ever really overcome that, like when something as good as Bonnie and Clyde comes out, it's sort of in people's brains forever.
The main things that bother me are two. One, when we make heroes out of true psychopaths, people who killed other people and killed, you know, innocent bystanders, if you want to call, you know, it's really bad. That's really, really bad. As a culture, we should somehow figure out how to deal with that. But also, a lot of movies will take fairly, I mean, not headline people, and really do a hatchet job on them. For instance, The Bridge on the River Kwai is about this POW camp where they build this bridge. The British POWs are meant to build this bridge, and the British officer in charge gets them to do a good job. You know, he wants it as a team building exercise so that the soldiers don't lose morale and all that sort of stuff. And he ends up sort of being a collaborator with the Japanese prison commander. And it's only at the very end he kind of realizes, my God, what have I done? This is literally opposite to what the commander at the British commander at that POW camp named Philip Tuzi was. He did everything he could to sabotage that bridge. You know, they built it, but they were also trying to you know, put, I don't know, faulty things in so that it would collapse, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so no one's ever heard of Philip Tuzi, or most people haven't. Lots of British people may have. But, you know, you're taking this guy's reputation and you're turning it into the exact opposite of what he was. And another one, much more recent one, the one called The Imitation Game, the Enigma movie. Well, not only was Alan Turing not there at Bletchley Park doing what he is doing in the movie, they compressed it all together to make it sort of logical and to make Alan Turing a hero, which is fine because he certainly was. But a lot of the second rank people in the movie, Colonel Nicholson, people like that, are being shown as anti-Turing and anti, you know, there's like, there has to be tension within the team. And it's literally not true. There's literally no evidence that this happened. And you know, so that at least changed the people's names in the movie. But they didn't – in that movie is particularly bad because they didn't change their names. Yeah. So the descendants of these people are like, well, wait a minute. That's my grandfather, my great-grandfather. That didn't happen. And you're making him look like practically a Nazi collaborator. And that sort of stuff really sends me over the edge.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I, you know, I think if you were teaching a class in history, you could almost just use a handful of films as kind of a starting point and then kind of going with there to dismantle it, because probably everyone's seen the movie and you kind of need to be going through every scene to kind of instruct people. And, you know, this didn't really happen. I mean, some people don't care. But it does happen where people bring something up and it's just something that they saw in a movie.
Yeah. And then it bothers me that people then will make their decisions on other things like politics and the way they vote based on these myths.
Yeah.
So they say, well, we need another Patton, or we need another so-and-so or whatever. And they're really basing that idea on their movie perception of Patton. The example I always use is not a movie about it so much, is Mussolini making the trains run on time. You know, you hear that, well, maybe you don't hear it as much as you used to, but you used to hear it all the time that, okay, we need a tough guy, or a guy will get stuff done, and we sort of have to look the other way if he stomps on civil liberties. But after all, Mussolini made the trains run on time. Well, Mussolini didn't make the trains run on time. The trains did not improve under Mussolini's leadership in Italy. So, in fact, exactly the historical quote evidence you're using unquote is wrong.
Yeah.
You know, and you're voting for someone who could be another sort of proto-fascist because you believe this, well, we need the trains to be sorted out and run on time, and Mussolini did that, and so, you know, we'll have to put up with this sort of racism, whatever it is. And that just again sends me around the bend.
Well,
it's one of the reasons I started the show. One of the reasons I started it.
No, I've heard that you kind of substitute your whoever European dictator, Hitler or Stalin. Some people have said that. Well, Stalin made the trains run on time. Yeah, he also killed 20 million people. You know, so
right. and probably it's probably not true that he made the trains run on time. I mean, I don't know what happened in Stalinistic Russia, But this efficiency of tough guys is just – there's just no evidence for it.
Well, and you've done an episode about Hitler and kind of really exploding that myth of Nazi efficiency even really.
Absolutely,
and,
yeah.
And Hitler
absolutely.
Himself was really kind of like – he was like a college student. He was like staying up late. He was sleeping in. He was, you know –
Yeah.
watching movies.
He was what Donald Trump would call a loser. Yeah, I'm saying it's true.
Yeah,
but it just so happens that these things, you know, the stars aligned properly for him, and he was able to become the chancellor and all everything else that happened.
Well, and I think, you know, to get back to Hollywood a little, like, you know, and in politics, you know, it took me a long time to sort of understand the importance of theater in whatever you're doing. So if you're a politician,
absolutely.
I mean, I'll give Trump credit in the sense that he understands theater and he's really,
yeah,
I mean, he's pretty much just a a circus, you know, he's running a circus. So he kind of understands mm-hmm. spectacle and keeping people entertained. And there is a lot of that in populism and certain politicians throughout history. People just want that. And I think mm-hmm. Hitler understood that with the rallies and the lights and the music and all that. I don't know if we got to all the questions I have, but that's okay. It's been an interesting discussion. But did you want to say again what you've kind of got going on or what's coming up on your show?
Let me check, because we're just changing things. What I'm trying to do now for the first time, and it's killing me in terms of project management or whatever. I'm going to try to do a show on the Notre Dame fire, on the Notre Dame fire.
Oh, yeah.
And use it to talk about how destruction of iconic architecture in the past in other circumstances has affected the way history has worked. And then the other thing is, we're going to do another show. I hope it'll come out in May on the Electoral College, because there have been these calls for the abolition of the Electoral College. And so what I'm trying to do is pay more attention to the news. Obviously the Notre Dame fire was huge and very obvious.
Yeah.
One. Pay more attention to the news and try to get a good show about the historical version of the historical background of that out as soon as possible. Whereas last year I would have said, oh, I could never do that in time. People have forgotten about the Electoral College by August or whatever. So that's what we got. We've got that coming up. Those are sort of the big things coming up at the end of April and the middle of May.
Okay. Well, to go back to Hitler again, I mean, were you thinking about talking about the Reichstag fire?
Well, that's a good example. I should use that. Yeah.
Just one that came to mind. Well, that was used for political purposes. I know it's not always doing that. I'm glad it's really taken off and it's worked out for you. And so you get to work from home?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Great. Which has its problems, because the couch is too handy.
Well, I have an almost four-year-old and a six-year-old. So some days I'm not getting anything done at home, but whatever.
That's good.
Joe, been great talking to you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. And hey, let's when you, even before you're finished with the Johnny Cash book, let's talk about that on my show.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic topic.
Whenever you're ready, I'm thinking I might need to send it to a publisher in the next, I don't know, by the end of the year, I think. I've been kind of working through it, but I've certainly been thinking about it a long time. So no, we could definitely, well, and speaking of myths, I mean, oh my God. I mean,
Oh yeah.
It just drives me crazy. And there's just no like Johnny Cash archive you can go to and look up his letters and say, oh, this is bullshit. It's just like something he made up and people kept repeating it. And
that's the way it happened.
You know, I think sometimes he wasn't even sure if it really happened or not. You know, he was probably stoned out of his mind, and maybe in his mind it did actually happen. I don't know.
But you never know.
But yeah, that'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'd love to do that. And I think listeners would love it too. So I'm looking forward to it. Because your first book, The Marching Masters, is a great book. Great book.
Thank you. And I'll plug your books. You've got the two, is it two books?
Yeah, people shouldn't buy my book on the Liberal Party. it's too specialized. It's too boring. But I have a book on Ireland.
That's done pretty well. It's in the fourth edition.
Yeah, and I think my publisher keeps asking me to do a fifth one. I'm just trying to find the time.
Oh, so you have to add like another chapter or something?
Yeah, and that book has always had in it historiographical essays at the end of each chapter. And I'm thinking about dropping those, because lots of people tell me they just skip over them.
Yeah, well,
it's very hard to keep up with that sort of thing.
No, it's kind of impossible.
It's out of date. Yeah,
Once you print it, it's out of date. It's out of date before you even print it for the history.
Yeah, so I'm thinking of dropping that, and maybe that'll give me space, so to speak, to talk about more.
Yeah,
narrative.
Maybe about. You can talk about Brexit.
That's right. Because the people in Ireland are sitting back and laughing. I mean, the border is a big problem, but most of the people in Ireland are laughing at the British because they really shot themselves in the foot.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. The border is kind of a sticking point there. What a mess. All right. Well, thanks again, Joe, and good luck with everything. And enjoy the rest of your spring break.
Great. Will do.
All right. Take care, man.
All right, that was my talk with Joe Kuhill, also known as Professor Buzzkill. I hope you enjoyed that. Check out Joe's books. He's got Ireland, A Short History, which is in its fourth edition. That is a book I should probably read since I do have a Irish ancestry, and I don't know much about Irish history, and it is a, as the title suggests, a short history. It is a brief book, and with the summer coming up and the beach and the pool and all, I'll have to have something to read by the pool, right? And he's also author of Ideas of the Liberal Party, Perceptions, Agendas, and Liberal Politics in the House of Commons. That book is from 2011. I know Joe was being self-deprecating about that, but that sounds like an interesting book too. So check out either of those. You can get those on Amazon. You can also check out my book, which there is a price alert for. It is no more expensive than $28 and some change now on Amazon. All the new copies are maxed out at $28. So if you're interested in the Civil War and slavery and emancipation and Southern history, check out Marching Masters. Hope you're doing okay. I will be talking with you soon. Take care. Bye.